Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today on this 4th of July holiday weekend, we will assess where we stand as a nation in terms of our freedom and our ability to pursue happiness in the land of the free and the home of the brave. We'll begin with Rabbi Michael Lerner, the rabbi at Beit Tikkun Synagogue in San Francisco and editor of Tikkun Magazine and author with Cornel West of Jews and Blacks, Let the Healing Begin. We'll discuss his article at the Huffington Post, Turn Independence Day, July the 4th, into Interdependence Day. Instead of celebrating bombs bursting in air, Rabbi Michael Lerner calls for us to transform the July 3 to 5 holiday to celebrate our interdependence with all human beings on this planet and our interdependence with the Earth, our badly abused planet. Then we'll examine where we stand today in terms of the freedoms proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence and enshrined in the Bill of Rights. Bruce Fein, a constitutional lawyer who was formerly a Deputy Associate Attorney General in the Reagan administration and is the author of American Empire Before the Fall, joins us to discuss whether U.S. presidents today have more power over us than King George III had over the American colonies, a tyranny that led to the American Revolution and the Declaration of Independence in 1776. Then finally, we will speak with Bernard Powers, a professor of history at the College of Charleston, who has published numerous works on African-American social and cultural evolution. We will discuss the extent to which African-Americans feel free today to pursue happiness, especially in South Carolina, the scene of the recent massacre at this historic AME church, and across the South, where a number of African-American churches have recently been burned down. And joining us now is Michael Lerner, the rabbi of Beit Tikkun Synagogue in San Francisco and the editor of Tikkun, a bi-monthly Jewish critique of politics, culture, and society. He's also co-chair, along with Cornel West and Sister Joan Chichester, of the Network of Spiritual Progressives. He is the author of The Left Hand of God, Taking Our Country Back from the Religious Right, and co-author with Cornel West of Jews and Blacks, Let the Healing Begin. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Turn Independence Day, July the 4th, into Interdependence Day. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lerner.
Hi, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And on this 4th of July weekend, how free do you feel? I mean, we own the land of the free and the home of the brave, but some of our citizens don't feel particularly free, both from government surveillance and intrusion into our lives. African Americans have experienced some terrible incidents over the last couple of years and up until very recently at a church in Charleston. Give us your sort of thermometer, if you will. Give us the temperature of America's freedom.
Well, America is a long way from living up to the promise of freedom that is enshrined in our Declaration of Independence, but never actually became a reality. When it said that all men are created equal, the people who wrote that meant to include all human beings, but very quickly that disappeared from the consciousness as first of all, because they didn't even think that Africans were real human beings, they're slaves. And secondly, because they, in the framing of the Constitution, did not include women. And subsequently, throughout our history, we have had a leadership, ruling elites that have not really validated the freedom of middle-income and working people, and immigrants of all sorts, and of course African Americans most intensely. Today we have several million people languishing in prisons in this country, most of whom should not be there, and so we're far away from where we want to be or where we ought to be, and where the rhetoric makes us think we are. And that's one of the problems about celebrating July 4th as an Independence Day, a day of celebrating freedom, unless we bring into those celebrations, number one, a very strong message that while we are deeply appreciative of what is true about the message of freedom, we're also deeply critical of what has not yet been actualized. And I have to say that obviously this is a complex message because those of us who just celebrated the decision of the Supreme Court to legalize gay marriage, recognize that the previous battles that have been fought by working people over the course of the past several hundred years in the United States has expanded the territory in which people can fight for further extensions of freedom, and sometimes, as in the case of gay rights, actually win something very significant and important. So there's a reason to celebrate America, and particularly to celebrate its working people and the movements that have struggled, often at very high cost to the people involved, losing jobs, getting beat up, sometimes imprisoned, sometimes killed. But nevertheless, those struggles have actually won something real. And what they have won is an extension of democracy, an extension of freedoms. And with the extension of democracy and extension of freedoms has come the possibility of new struggles. And sometimes we actually win those struggles. So there's something very wonderful about that system, something that's really to be valued in that system. And those of us who spend most of the rest of the year critiquing what isn't there have reason and ought to take a day to celebrate what is there. So that's why I'm in favor of us, all of us who are committed to social transformation, to celebrate what's good in America and to affirm what's good in America. But simultaneously, we have to have another consciousness that has to be raised here, because even though it's important to celebrate what's good here, when we talk about Independence Day, I think we tend to very quickly fall back into either the rhetoric of American exceptionalism, chauvinism, nationalism, militarism that is symbolized most greatly by the bombs bursting in air, which the various fireworks shows are meant to in some way recapitulate for people. On the one hand, lots of people love the beauty of those fireworks. On the other hand, the loud noises that are set off all around the country are meant to re-stimulate the sense of, we're proud to have a strong military, we're proud to have bombs bursting in air. And I think we have to stay away from that and affirm a different vision of the United States, of what we are for here. But we simultaneously have to even question the whole notion of independence at this moment, because more and more the reality of the world is that we are interdependent with all of the rest of the of reality. We are independent with all other human beings on the planet, and we are interdependent with our Earth. And so what we at Tikkun, T-I-K-K-U-N, it means to heal, repair, and transform the world, but it's a magazine, and it's a movement that we call the Network of Spiritual Progressives, although you don't have to be religious to be part of it. You don't have to believe in God or anything like that. What we are saying is that we need to transform this day of independence to a day of interdependence. And so instead of what most people who have some degree of political consciousness do around July 4th is they turn it into a purely family time for vacation, visit to the beach, a picnic, and block out the larger political meanings that are associated with it. I'm saying no. We need to transform that day, not block out the political meanings, but transform the political meanings. Number one, to affirm what's good in America, because I think it's really important for people who have progressive instincts, liberal and progressive instincts, who are always heard critiquing, to have a day in which we affirm the good parts of America, namely the parts that have allowed people to struggle and expand rights. But secondly, to insist on our interdependence with all other people on the planet and interdependence with the planet itself. And I think that that, rather than just saying, I don't want to think about the political meanings, I'll escape them, I'll avoid them, no, let's transform them. Let's go into the public arena. Let's affirm what's good in the United States, even as we remind people of the struggles that are needed more, but also reject the notion of independence and affirm the notion of interdependence.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Lerner, the rabbi of Beit Tikkun Synagogue in San Francisco and the editor of Tikkun, a bi-monthly Jewish critique of politics, culture, and society. He's also co-chair with Cornel West and Sister Joan Chittison of the Network of Spiritual Progressives. He is the co-author of The Left Hand of God, Taking Our Country Back from the Religious Right, and co-author with Cornel West of Jews and Blacks, Let the Healing Begin. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Turn Independence Day, July the 4th, into Interdependence Day. And of course, you're one of the first rabbis in the U.S. to conduct gay and lesbian marriages. And there's no question that the LGBTQT community have made enormous advances in a very short period of time, as the president recently said, striking like a thunderbolt, this recent Supreme Court decision. On the other hand, African Americans feel that their progress has been restricted, which it clearly has, and they are continuing the struggle. Recently, the largest growing demographic in the country, the Latino vote, has been insulted by a Republican candidate, Donald Trump, who has, since he made those racist insults, has actually gone up in the polls in terms of Republican primary voters. The one thing that strikes me, Rabbi Lerner, that unites us all being the 99%, is what is in the Declaration of Independence that you mentioned earlier, that after the passage where it says deriving their just powers from the governed, the next line is, and if a government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to overthrow it. At what point do you think we're at in terms of our democracy being controlled by money, the oligarchy essentially taking over our democracy? Do you think that we are at that time?
Yes, we've been there for a while, and that's why our interfaith and secular humanist and atheist welcoming network of spiritual progressives, it has developed a plan called the ESRA, the Environmental and Social Responsibility Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and this amendment. It goes way beyond the paltry moves of Move to Amend, because Move to Amend only seeks to get the Congress to set the conditions for money in politics, and of course that's very unreliable since the Congress is itself very much controlled by the moneyed interests. So the ESRA, the Environmental and Social Responsibility Amendment to the Constitution, says is that all national and state elections must be publicly funded exclusively. No other money can be allowed in those elections. In other words, not from corporations, not from individuals. Because even if you ban corporations, rich individuals could have huge impact. Sheldon Adelson and many others, the Koch brothers. We need to ban money from politics altogether, and to only allow that money which is given equal amounts to all the significant candidates from the federal and this would be on state as well as on national elections. And the second part of the ESRA, because you think, well, that should be enough to get money out of politics and bring it back to a democracy, right? No, it's not. Because in the economy, the way it works today, large corporations can bully the state and national government by simply saying, you know, we're going to move our resources out of this country or out of this state or out of this country if you start passing legislation that gives workers too many rights or that gives the environment too much protection and that cuts into our bottom line of money. So the second part of the ESRA says the following. Every corporation with an income of above $50 million a year, So here we're not talking about mom and pop local stores. We're talking about the bigger corporations. Every corporation with incomes above $50 million a year must get a new corporate charter once every 5 years. And that new corporate charter will only be granted to those corporations which can prove a satisfactory history of environmental and social responsibility to a jury of ordinary citizens who will hear testimony from citizens in the United States and also from people all around the world who have been affected by the environmental and social and economic policies of that corporation, and can take all that into account when determining whether this corporation deserves a new corporate charter. Now, that will put a very severe restriction on corporate ability to dictate to local cities or states or even the federal government policies that it can either succeed in getting or threaten to move its resources entirely out of this country.
And Rabbi Lerner, in your article at the Huffington Post, Turn Independence Day, July the 4th, into Interdependence Day, you say that let us transform the July 3 to 5 holiday to celebrate our interdependence with all human beings on this planet and our interdependence with the Earth, our badly abused planet. Recently, Pope Francis, in his encyclical on the environment, made it very clear. I mean, the language was extraordinary. He talked about, warned that the planet could end up as an immense pile of filth. He made it clear that it, in effect, global capitalism, the imperative for growth and for consumerism, is incompatible with the biosphere. I take it that you're in step with what he's saying, because I think at the end of the day, you could take it further and say, well, you know, we've got to get rid of nationalism because we've got to actually consider and evolve and adopt a new form of global patriotism, because we're all in this little lifeboat Earth and we're all threatened equally.
Yes. Well, I mean, first of all, I want to say about the Pope that what he did was wonderful, and fantastic, a tremendous thing. And secondly, I want to say about the Pope and about the gay marriage decision that both of these are, both of these in their own way, are manifestations of a deep truth, which is that it is always an error to be realistic, to believe that what is possible is what the people in power tell you is possible. So many good liberals and good progressives narrow their focus in politics to what they think is realistic and what can be won. And so instead of putting forward their larger vision of the world that they want, they often narrow to the specific struggle. No fracking in L.A., right, or some, you know, but not the larger transformation of the society, and that the need to overcome global capitalism and the need to build a world based on love and generosity and ethical and environmental sensitivity. So what you should learn from the Pope and from the movement, the GLBT movements, is don't be realistic. Don't accept the contours of what people tell you is possible. But instead, go for your highest vision of the good, because you never know what's possible until you join a movement and struggle for what is desirable. And so so in those respects, that's extremely important. Now, the next part of what you're saying is also extremely important, which is, and this is why I'm calling for, and we at the Network of Spiritual Progressives are calling for, using the July 3rd to 5th time to celebrate our interdependence with all of reality, because with all other people on the planet and with the planet itself. And that is that we may need, in order to save the planet, we may need to overcome all of these national entities and to replace them with some other form of connection, like bioregions that are not based on previous national conquests and power struggles, but based on trying to save the Earth. And so one of the things that Tikkun magazine has argued for is a global Marshall Plan to to redistribute wealth in such a way as to eliminate poverty, and both in the United States and around the world, and then to eliminate all borders, down with all borders, to let people travel wherever they want to go and live wherever they want to live. Now, of course, in the current maldistribution of wealth, that would be impossible because everyone would want to come to a few of the advanced industrial countries, including the United States, and we would not be able to sustain that. We can't have 7 billion people living here. But we could, but if we redistributed our wealth in such a way as to make it possible for people to be living at a sustainable level financially in wherever they lived, not everybody would come here. We would not be flooded in the same way. And at that point, it becomes possible really to talk about the way we called this in Tikkun Magazine's cover story a few issues ago was away with all borders, away with all borders. So now that doesn't mean that we have to eliminate national particularities or religious particularities or ethnic or any form of particular communities. We don't have to all be one massive glob together with no particular identities, but we have to simultaneously, while maintaining our particular identities, foster a global consciousness and foster a real commitment to the well-being of everyone else on the planet.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Rabbi Michael Lerner, on this 4th of July holiday weekend.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Lerner, who's the rabbi of Beit Tikkun Synagogue in San Francisco. He's the editor of Tikkun, a bimonthly Jewish critique of politics, culture, and society. And he's also the co-chair, along with Cornel West and Sister Joan Chittister, of the Network of Spiritual Progressives. He is the author of The Left Hand of God, Taking Our Country Back from the Religious Right, and co-author with Cornel West of Jews and Blacks, Let the Healing Begin. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Turn Independence Day, July the 4th, into Interdependence Day. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back examining where we stand in terms of the freedoms proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence and enshrined in the Bill of Rights.
That's how we start the show. Eagle soar and oil flow. You didn't decide what you chose. We will pay back what they owe. Crime depends from who you sold. We cheer for the villains though. Hustling, bustling, getting low. Motion is perpetual. We call jewels to give and go. All you reap is what you sow. Where are the controls? Mass of individuals consuming as ritual. You ain't hear them say ride slow. Dudes, don't let them play us. Girls, they are.
Looking for a sign, I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Beware the savage yore of 1984. Oh, see, come see, remember me.
They got it all night moving round. You said it would last, but I guess we grow.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bruce Fine, who's a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as the Associate Deputy Attorney General under the Reagan administration, General Counsel to the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He has authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international laws, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. Bruce Fine is the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy, and his latest book is American Empire, Before the Fall. He has been a senior policy advisor to Ron Paul's 2012 campaign and was the lawyer for Edward Snowden's father, Lon. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Fine.
Thank you for inviting me, Ian.
And Bruce, on this 4th of July weekend, in the land of the free and the home of the brave, how free do you feel?
Well, we're not free because we have come full circle in more than two centuries to now embrace a president who exercises vast more unchecked power than did King George III, whose tyranny provoked a revolution on July 4th, 1776. And it's something that's come about more on the installment plan rather than, you know, like an 18th of Brumaire when Napoleon suddenly overthrew and undertook a counter-revolution against the French Revolution. But we now, if I could just enumerate some of the powers of the president that are truly awesome, really, in the history of government. Most prominently, he claims the power and utilized it on at least five occasions to kill any American citizen who, based on secret evidence, he declares is an imminent threat to the United States. It's not a decision that's subject to any review by any court, by Congress, or otherwise. He just decides, and he can vaporize you, and that's the end of the matter. There's no due process whatsoever. Now, it's true that President Obama, five times in his presidency, that's not a huge number, but even one sets a precedent that, lies around like a loaded weapon, ready for use by any Caligula who operates in the White House. It's a truly terrifying power, vastly greater than anything that King George III was wielding. Another usurpation is the authority to decide when to cross the Rubicon from peace to war. He's done that in Libya. He's done that with ISIS. He's written a memoranda, as Justice Department has, asserting that he has the right to go to war at his whim. He obviously believes, in my judgment, as I think Congress does, if he thinks Iran is a nuclear danger, he will unilaterally decide whether to bomb or invade Iran. He will unilaterally decide whether there's been cyber warfare that justifies a kinetic response. There's no participation by Congress or the American people with regard to his authority to surveil us in a Big Brother type of approach where there's no probable cause or particularized suspicion that we're doing anything wrong. Now, he basically has his NSA putting us, it's like the Jeremy Bentham's panopticon in a prison. Surveil and gather information against all of us because at some future time maybe it could be of some use, even though in the last 10 years it's been utterly futile in deterring or detecting a single terrorist attack against any American. It's a pulverization, if you will, of the Fourth Amendment right to privacy. And just think how that sounds, Ian, compared to the very, very famous statement that in some sense was a provocation of the American Revolution itself. Came about in 1763 when William Pitt the Elder was protesting the general writs of assistance, the authorities that the British were using to invade anyone's home or his business in search of contraband or unpaid taxes. And I'll take the indulgence to really repeat what he said because it's so thrilling in comparison to what we accept today as almost sheep. And he spoke to the Parliament in Great Britain. The poorest man in his cottage may bid defiance to all the forces of the crown. It may be frail, the roof may shake, the storms may enter, the wind may blow through it, the rain may enter, but the King of England cannot enter. All his forces dare not cross the threshold of the ruined tenement. Now, those were the words of strength and willingness to confront authority and to ensure an enclave of privacy. So you could act spontaneously. You had a right to be left alone just because you're a human being. And the burden was always on the government to demonstrate some compelling interest to invade it. And that's obsolete today. I mean, the government says, unless you have something to hide, you shouldn't worry about us spying and understanding everything about your life. No matter how much it could be used to intimidate or blackmail you or otherwise. That's not the America that was declared in 1776, but it's the America that we have today. And it's exceedingly, I think, unfortunate because we still have the institutions. If we have the political will and courage to regain our freedom that we had in 1776 that we no longer have. Now, I do want to, however, make this reservation in some respects, and that is we are far better off, at least with regard to equality today, than in 1776. We no longer have slavery. Women are no longer subjugated. We don't oppress people because of their religion. And so there's greater equality under the law. But we're all equally, enslaved to an all-powerful government, even though the discrimination and the slavery has now been eliminated, if you will.
Again, I'm speaking with Bruce Fine, who's a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General under the Reagan administration, General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He has authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. Bruce Fine is the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy, and his latest book is American Empire Before the Fall. He has been a senior policy advisor to Ron Paul's 2012 campaign and was the lawyer for Edward Snowden's father, Lon. But given that President Obama's predecessor, George W. Bush, took us into three wars, the war on terror, the war in Afghanistan, and the war in Iraq, and his successor, President Obama, was supposed to get us out of wars, and as you pointed out, he's got us at least into a couple, albeit not on the scale of his predecessor. But so you're talking really about the power in the presidency, not the person who's in the...
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct. It's the institution, and it's, you know, I'm not... If it was just the idiosyncratic personality of the president, I'd be less worried. But this is a pattern that really has begun ever since World War II with Harry Truman's unilateral decision to go into Korea in violation of the Constitution as pledged to Senate. And you can go through the Gulf of Tonkin resolutions, the unilateral actions that the presidents have taken consistently since, you know, really the Korean War in 1950. That's not a Republican or Democrat issue. It's not an Obama or Bush issue. They're all doing it. And it's because we have this empire mentality that craves this risk-free existence, needs to dominate the world so no one can do anything that we may disapprove of. And the result is that we end up surrendering our liberties and freedom at home in the name of trying to conquer and police the entire world, which is futile in any event. But I do want to say this, that just like Obama's, you know, he inherited Bush's wars, but he could have shut them down. He didn't start them, but the president can shut them down anytime he wants. And just the successor to Obama will be able to shut down anything Obama began. Obama said, well, the war against ISIS is going to be 6 years, 8 years, could be 15, could be 100. Nothing binds a new president from following the activities of the foreign policy of his previous one. And so I don't go with this idea that you can just blame the previous president for what is occurring under an incumbent. The president calls the shots. The decision lies there, and he's got to take accountability for things that he continues as well as things that he begins himself.
But President Obama would argue, I've tried to shut Guantanamo down, and he's failed to do so.
Yeah, he has failed to shut down Guantanamo, and I think that under the law, he has a right, you know, because to tell anyone, all the inmates there, that the law just prohibits him from himself transferring custody of an inmate. They're about over 100 now to a third party. You can just say, well, all right, we're not transferring custody, but anyone who wants to pick up these prisoners is free to do so because they're not been viewed as a threat to the United States. But I think even more important on that score is the fact that he could take the position that it's unconstitutional to detain people without accusing them of a crime and trying them, even for a military commissioner, letting them go, and that a federal statute cannot force the president to engage in unconstitutional action, which is, means detention without accusation or trial, which is what we associate with Star Chamber and what happened by King Louis the 16th before the French Revolution. That would be bold, and I would suggest that he do that. If these people are sufficiently dangerous, they must have committed some kind of crime, material assistance to a terrorist organization, that would enable them to be tried. And the fact is, if they've been tortured so we no longer have evidence that's free of taint, you know, that's our problem. You know, that's what the Eighth Amendment and the Constitution requires in some instances, even if you have a guilty person, in order to deter the most heinous, you know, grisly kinds of tactics. You don't permit a prosecution based upon evidence obtained by the rack and the screw or waterboarding or other forms of torture.
So how do you restore proportionality, though, in terms of the public consciousness? You know, Bruce Fine, that since the war on terror, there's been extraordinary hyperbole from leaders at the Pentagon and then in the White House, particularly during the Bush-Cheney administration, that this is the greatest threat we face. I mean, we survived for, three or four decades with every city in the United States targeted by Soviet nuclear weapons that within 30 minutes could have vaporized the entire United States and most of the world. And somehow we got through that. And that was a real, real threat. I mean, 9/11 was a terrible event, but one nuclear weapon exploding on an American city would have been an unimaginable catastrophe, let alone thousands. So my sense is that a part of our conditioning to accept this infringement on our rights has been the lack of a public debate about proportionality.
Well, you're absolutely right. It's just a characteristic of empire that it inflates a genuine danger by a factor of about 1 million or 2 million and says, Chicken Little, the sky is falling. We have to suspend all of our rights. And American people can be frightened because they're not given context. And it isn't just the Bush-Cheney people. Right now, you take the national security establishment, the James Clappers and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they're testifying these very days, Ian, that we have never confronted a more dangerous peril to our sovereignty in their lifetimes. You know, you and I lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis and knows what nonsense that is, you know. Cuban Missile Crisis, as you point out, it could have destroyed the whole globe. And ISIS is horrible as it is. No, they're not a sovereign threat. You know, they have internecine warfare, and they don't have an army. They don't have a navy. They don't have an air force. They don't have nuclear weapons. They don't have tax power. They don't have conscription power, a whole host of things. You know, they got 20,000 at maximum support personnel, and most of it is teenagers. So all the administrations have inflated this fear factor in order to obtain greater and greater power. And also, I do think that the country itself is, even though there's no genuine existential threat, you know, there's this desire to think that you can live in a free, risk-free world. And the only way it can be risk-free is if we conquer the whole world, and that means subordinating everything to national security. You know, life isn't that easy, and it's not worth it, you know, to surrender our liberty in the name of trying to conquer and extinguish every risk in life. If you wanted to extinguish every risk, we should imprison everybody in the world because everybody's capable of an act of a Lucifer or a Satan at one time. If you want no risk, we're all in prison. But you're absolutely right. The leadership has been woefully deficient in instead of putting the real risk in context. For example, you're more likely to die of a vending machine falling on you than by a terrorist attack. Trying to make it appear as though this is the greatest danger, not maybe since World War II, or maybe more dangerous than World War II, and thinking that we have to surrender all of our liberties instantaneously, or else we'll be conquered and or we'll have beheadings in the United States. But I, you know, other than just electing different leaders, all we can do is encourage someone to stand up and be courageous and tell the truth to power.
So in terms of a lot of what we've discussed applies to the Fourth Amendment and the extent to which it's been eroded, what other amendments do you think are in jeopardy?
Well, certainly due process is in jeopardy. When the president claims the authority, he can detain you without accusation or charge, he can vaporize you based upon his decision alone. Those are very, very deep incursions on the Fifth Amendment right to due process of law. Then there are other elements as well that come in. I don't know whether I would call it basically the right of transparent government. We've got secret government going everywhere. We don't know what the government is doing because they hide everything behind classified information. Just think, we don't even know today as citizens what are the standards the president uses to instruct, drones to kill. And we know they end up killing many civilians. We, the people, need to have the right to decide as a matter of our policy whether we want signature killings based upon the fact that someone may be having a beard and he's within proximity of 100 miles of where al-Qaeda is known to operate, or whether we don't want to be implicated in a reckless killing that's going to commit injustice. That's for the American people to decide, and obviously not directly in an initiative, but by exercising a judgment and encouraging the Congress or the president to do things. You know, how we oppose opposition to the Vietnam War, for example, at one time. But how can you voice opposition or even support? You don't even know what's going on and why. All of this is under a cloak of secrecy, thousands of predator drones being used, and we don't even know what the standards are. And that's really a deprivation of the right of self-government. We may make errors. The human species is not infallible. Of course, neither is the president. But we have a right on serious issues to chart our own destiny. And you can't do it when it's secret. And now, and it's even becoming more acute today with cyber warfare, cyber conflict, you know, arising its head. We don't know why Obama decided to say that the break into the Sony, the hack into the Sony electronic storage materials was vandalism and wasn't something else. Does he just get to decide whether it's vandalism? How did he reach that conclusion? We are clueless about that. We'll be clueless if the president stands up and says, oh, we've had a cyber warfare attack from China and now we're at war with China. We don't know what China's done. It's just based upon what he says alone. And that perhaps is the most precious liberty that we had in 1776. No, we pronounced government by the consent of the government. You know, transparency was the rule. Exceptions maybe for the location of troops, but that was about all. And all of that is being lost today with the national security state just saying, no, we don't want to tell you. And sometimes when you ask us, we lie, like the director of national intelligence lying when he testified under oath. He was not collecting data on millions of Americans when he was collecting data on all 320 million Americans.
Well, Bruce Fein, I think on this 4th of July weekend, you've given us an awful lot to think about. Do you have, just in the last minute, is there any invocation that you can offer that gives us hope, that will stiffen our backbones and make us restore the freedoms that were bequeathed to us?
I think, Ian, we should be proud of the fact that our institutions, the architecture that gave us our freedom, still is intact. And, you know, and it was not all that long ago when the American people opposed, you know, President Obama's effort to get us into war with Syria. And the system worked. And the president backed down and Congress backed down and we weren't at full-fledged war with Syria. But that has to become the norm rather than the very, very rare exception. And there's another element, too, I think, that we need to go back to, you know, the fundamental philosophy of what it meant, you know, to be an American. And we don't deny that if we want to become wealthy and rich in material comfort, that's fine. But that's not the earmark of the United States. And let me just close by quoting from Sam Adams. He was one of the true firebrands of the American Revolution. And he obviously confronted, as maybe we are today, the difficulty of awakening the American colonists at the time to the need for independence from an oppressive government abroad. And what he said was as follows. Ye who prefer wealth better than liberty, the tranquility of servitude better than the animating contest for freedom, go home from us in peace. We ask not your advice or arms. Crouch down and lick the hand that feeds you. Let your chains sit lightly upon you, and let posterity forget ye were our countrymen. You know, that was the spirit of the American Revolution. Not that we decried efforts at self-improvement economically or otherwise, but the real spirit of America is the spirit of liberty, the right to chart our own destiny and accepting moral responsibility from the outcome and insisting on transparent government. And there's nothing that has to be a budget item. We can recapture the United States just by changing our attitude. It's a state of mind. It's a state of ambition. And the system is there if we're willing to push forward to recapture our liberty from a Leviathan government.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Bruce Fein, on this 4th of July weekend.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Bruce Fein, as a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan Administration, General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He has authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. Bruce Fein is the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy, and his latest book is American Empire Before the Fall. And he's been a senior policy advisor to Ron Paul's 2012 campaign and was the lawyer for Edward Snowden's father, Lon. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about whether African Americans feel free today to pursue happiness. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bernard Powers, a professor of history at the College of Charleston, who has published numerous works on African-American social and cultural evolution. He was associate editor for the South Carolina Encyclopedia and is the author of Black Charlestonians, A Social History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bernard Powers.
Hi, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And on this 4th of July holiday weekend, Bernard, you, of course, are in Charleston, South Carolina, the home of Mother Emanuel, the AME church that was violated and desecrated by this hideous massacre that took place, which has galvanized the nation, but unfortunately hasn't been the first incident of violence against African Americans. So on this holiday where we celebrate our freedoms and the unique right in America to pursue happiness, where do you think African Americans stand today in terms of freedom and the ability to pursue happiness?
Well, I think in thinking about that large question, one has to think about it in a couple of ways. One has to think about it over the long term, and one has to think about it also over the short term. And I think it's pretty obvious over the long term, there's been a tremendous amount of progress made in the country, particularly when one thinks about the Declaration of Independence and the era that produced it, and also the hand that produced it, that hand being that of Thomas Jefferson. And, of course, at that point in time, overwhelmingly, the black population in the United States, or the emerging United States, was enslaved. So there was no ability to pursue one's happiness. There was no ability to even control one's person during that time period. And obviously, the situation has changed dramatically as a result of the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement. However, short term, one has to fully realize that the prize of liberty and justice, freedom, equality, and the fulfillment of God's inalienable rights have not been achieved as of yet. And the struggle continues by which people try to achieve their full potential, their full humanity, their full social and economic rights. And so I think the watchword right now in 2015, as we celebrate the 4th of July, a holiday, the watchword has to be eternal vigilance, because on certain fronts there are movements afoot designed to undermine rights already gained. But we have to also think about going forward and achieving the complete and total fulfillment of the promise of America, which is going to require additional struggle.
So, Bernard Powers, obviously, given what's just happened in your city and the funerals that have taken place since and the president's extraordinary eulogy at the AME Church, it all happened in a very dramatic week with a lot of important Supreme Court decisions. But essentially, I think there is a comparison in the sense that the gay and lesbian community in a very short period of time. In fact, the president said the ruling came like a thunderbolt, and suddenly the rights of a minority in our country have been granted. A victory for rights for a minority in this country have come to fruition after a struggle, but nothing like a struggle in a sense that the African-American communities had. And you can't help noticing a contrast between the relatively quick period of time between when gays and lesbians in this country were ostracized and marginalized and in the shadows, and how they have become equal in terms of marriage, etc., in what most people say is a fairly short time. So what explains the speed of that and the relatively long and difficult struggle that the African-American communities had?
Sure. And I think the answer to that question resides in the difference in the relative threat posed by the two different groups. And what I mean by that is that people of African descent have been demonized in different ways, in ways that prove to be more threatening to the larger white population. From the very beginning, early on, in terms of the contact between African people and Europeans, the African population and those people that have derived from Africans, their descendants, have been identified as inferior, and have been identified as a source of every kind of contamination, and have been identified really as a lower order of humanity that Europeans and white Americans needed to protect themselves against. And if one only thinks about, for example, 1915, the film, the cinematic bombshell, The Birth of a Nation. Well, the villain of that film was allegedly a black man who was supposed to be a rapist. And so African American men have been historically represented as that kind of threat to white men and white women. Now, on the other hand, the gay and lesbian communities have not been similarly demonized. They've been certainly looked down upon, but for the most part, in American history, these populations have been hidden. We use the expression have been in the closet. And so they have not really posed historically the same kind of threat to white society and white humanity and even white life. When you think about, if you go back to the institution of slavery, there was always this fear that the slaves would get out of control and rise up, a la Nat Turner, for example, and kill white people. One of the greatest fears that white Americans had in the aftermath of the American Civil War was that the newly freed slave population would do what? They would rise up and engulf the entire South in an insurrection. And so there was this tremendous fear, and there always has been this tremendous fear of a black violence and the kind of cultural and other forms of contamination that emanated from the black population. And again, lesbian population simply has not posed that magnitude of threat. I think, and particularly in recent years, the gay and lesbian communities have posed more of a cultural threat, in the sense that they have articulated a different vision of family and romantic relationships and so on and so forth. And that, while that has been threatening on a cultural level, it's not really posed a threat to white life the way that black men and women, to a lesser extent, have been so represented.
But in terms of the role of corporate America, clearly corporate America is exerting itself both in terms of not tolerating the kind of casual homophobia that's been expressed by a lot of politicians, not to mention the racism just expressed by Donald Trump towards Latinos, but also the extent to which the Confederate battle flag is now being taken down in the South. Walmart and big corporations have refused to merchandise it anymore. I'm seeing all of that happening on the one hand, but just following what happened at Mother Emanuel, it's almost inconceivable to me that African American churches could be burned down as they are being burned down in the South. So on the one hand, you've got progress. On the other hand, you've got this malignant hatred still festering.
Sure. And of course, those two things, unfortunately, do go together in the sense that the terroristic attacks on black churches and the attack that happened here against black personhood in the form of nine people whose lives were taken at Mother Emanuel, this is the reaction to the kind of progress that African Americans have been making. And the sad thing about it is that, you know, again, right after the Civil War, when African Americans began to create institutions, began to realize their new opportunities to educate themselves formally in schools and churches were the special objects of white hostility and attack, and many of them were similarly burned by people who formerly had worn Confederate uniforms and had fought during the Civil War in order to preserve the institution of slavery. Now, today, what we're seeing is we're seeing an African-American president, and we've seen other high-profile African-American appointments at the national level, and at virtually every level of government, African-Americans have a presence. We are seeing increasingly African-Americans who are able to move into suburban areas, live a middle-class life, and so on and so forth. And it's unfortunate, but there's been a reaction to that, and some of that is very negative and comes out in the ways that we have seen here recently. But I think there's another aspect to this problem that some of us have talked about for decades, and only now we're really seeing these things realized, and that is the whole demographic shift that is occurring in America at this time. And we know that within a couple of decades, the United States, for the first time in its history, will become a quote-unquote majority-minority population. And that is very unsettling to the racist mentality. And so we're seeing people lash out at these kinds of changes, these kinds of shifts, and they are attacking the symbol and the substance of the people that they oppose.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Bernard Powers, on this 4th of July holiday.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Bernard Powers, who's a professor of history at the College of Charleston, who has published numerous works on African-American social and cultural evolution. He was associate editor for the South Carolina Encyclopedia and is the author of Black Charlestonians, A Social History. This has been a special July the 4th weekend edition of Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again on Monday at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.